Chapter 7
Skade, I'm afraid there's been another accident.
What kind of accident?
A State 2 excursion.
How long did it last?
Only a few milliseconds. It was enough, though.
The two of them, Skade and her senior propulsion technician, were crouched in a black-walled space near Nightshade's stern, while the prototype was berthed in the mother nest. They were squeezed into the space with their backs arched and their knees pressed against their chests. It was unpleasant, but after her first few visits, Skade had blanked out the sensation of postural comfort, replacing it with a cool zen-like calm. She could endure days squashed into inhumanly small hideaways, and she had. Beyond the walls, secluded in numerous cramped openings, were the intricate and perplexing elements of the machinery. Direct control and fine-tuning of the device was only possible here, where there were only the most rudimentary links to the normal control network of the ship.
Is the body still here?
Yes.
I'd like to see it. There isn't an awful lot left to see. But the man unplugged his compad and led the way, shuffling sideways in a crab-like manner. Skade followed him. They moved from one hideaway to another, occasionally having to inch through constrictions caused by protruding elements of the machinery. It was all around them, exerting its subtle but undeniable effect on the very space-time in which they were embedded. No one, not even Skade, really understood quite how the machinery worked. There were guesses, some of them very scholarly and plausible, but at heart there remained a gaping chasm of conceptual ignorance. Much of what Skade knew about the machinery consisted only of documented cause and effect, with little understanding of the physical mechanisms underpinning its behavior. She knew that when the machinery was functioning, it tended to settle into several discrete states, each of which was associated with a measurable change in the local metric. But the states were not rigidly isolated, and it had been known for the device to oscillate wildly between them. Then there was the associated problem of the various field geometries and the tortuously complex way they fed back into the state's stability.
State 2, you said. Exactly what mode were you in before the accident?
State 1, as per instructions. We were exploring some of the non-linear field geometries.
What was it this time? Heart failure? Like the last one?
No, at least I don't think heart failure was the main cause of death. Like I said, there isn't much left to go on.
Skade and the technician pushed ahead, wriggling through a tight elbow between adjoining chunks of the machinery. The field was in state 0 at the moment, for which there were no measurable physiological effects, but Skade could not entirely shake a feeling of wrongness, a nagging sense that the world had been skewed minutely away from normality. It was illusory. She would have needed highly sensitive quantum vacuum probes to detect the device's influence, but the feeling was there all the same.
Here we are.
Skade looked around. They had emerged into one of the larger open spaces in the bowels of the device. It was a scalloped, black-walled chamber just large enough to stand up in. Numerous compad input sockets woodwormed the walls.
This is where it happened?
Yes. The field shear was at its highest here.
I'm not seeing a body.
You're just not looking closely enough.
She followed his gaze. He was focusing on a particular part of the wall. Skade moved over and touched the wall with the gloved tips of her fingers. What had looked like the same gloss black as the rest of the chamber revealed itself to be scarlet and cloying. There was perhaps a quarter of an inch of something glued to most of the wall on one side of the chamber.
Please tell me this isn't what I think it is.
I'm afraid it's exactly what you think it is.
Skade stirred her hand through the red substance. The covering had enough adhesion to form a single sticky mass, even in zero gravity. Now and then she felt something harder, a shard of bone or machinery, but nothing larger than a thumbnail had remained in one piece.
Tell me what happened.
He was near the field focus. The excursion to State 2 was only momentary, but it was enough to make a difference. Any movement would have been fatal, even an involuntary twitch. Maybe he was already dead before he hit the wall.
How fast was he moving?
Kilometers per second, easily.
It would have been painless, I suppose. Did you feel him hit?
Throughout the ship. It was like a small bomb going off. Skade willed her gloves to clean themselves. The residue flowed back onto the wall. She thought of Clavain, wishing that she had some of his tolerance for sights like this. Clavain had seen horrid things during his time as a soldier, enough that he had developed the necessary mental armor to cope. With one or two exceptions, Skade had fought all her battles at a distance. Skade? Her crest must have reflected her discomposure. Don't worry about me. Just try to find out what went wrong, and make sure it doesn't happen again. And the testing program? The program continues, of course. Now get this mess cleaned up. Felker floated in another chamber of her quiet residential spa. Where tools had been tethered to her waist earlier, many small metal cages now orbited her, clacking gently against each other when she moved. Each cage contained a clutch of white mice, scratching and sniffing at their constraints. Felker paid them no attention. They had not been caged for long. They were well fed, and shortly they would all enjoy a sort of freedom. She squinted into gloom. The only source of light was the faint radiance of the adjacent room, separated from this one by a twisting throat of highly polished wood the color of burned caramel. She found the UV lamp attached to one wall and flicked it on. One side of the chamber, Felker had never bothered deciding which way was up, was sheeted over with bottle green glass. Behind the glass was something that, at first glance, resembled a convoluted wooden plumbing system, a palimpsest of pipes and channels, gaskets and valves and pumps. Diagonals and doglegs of wood spanned the maze, bridging different regions, their function initially unclear. The pipes and channels had only three wooden sides, with the glass forming the fourth wall so that whatever flowed or scurried along them would be visible. Felker had already introduced about a dozen mice to the system via one-way doors near the edge of the glass. They had quickly taken divergent paths at the first few junctions and were now meters apart, nosing through their own regions of the labyrinth. The lack of gravity did not bother them at all. They could obtain enough traction against the wood to scamper freely in any direction. The more experienced mice, in fact, eventually learned the art of coasting down pipes, minimizing the frictional area they exposed to the wood or glass. But they seldom learned that trick until they had been in the maze for several hours and through several reward cycles. Felker reached for one of the cages attached to her waist, flipping open the catch so that the contents, three white mice, spilled into the maze. Away they went, momentarily gleeful to have escaped the metal prisons. Felker waited. Sooner or later one of the mice would run into a trapdoor or flap that was connected to a delicate system of spring-loaded wooden levers. When the mouse pushed past the flap, the movement caused the levers to shift. The movement would often be transmitted across the maze, causing a shutter to open or close 1 or 2 meters away from the original trigger point. Another mouse, working its way through a remote stretch of the maze, might suddenly find its way blocked, where previously it had been clear. Or the mouse might be forced to make a decision where previously none had been required, anxieties of possibility momentarily clouding its tiny rodent brain. It was quite probable that the choices of the second mouse would activate another trigger system, causing a distant reconfiguration of another part of the maze. Floating in the middle, Felker would watch it happen, the wood shifting through endless permutations, running a blind program whose agents were the mice themselves. It was fascinating enough to watch, after a fashion. But Felker was easily bored. The maze, for her, was just the start of things. She would run the maze in semi-darkness with the UV lamp burning. The mice had genes that expressed a set of proteins that caused them to fluoresce under ultraviolet illumination. She could see them clearly through the glass, moving smudges of bright purple. Felker watched them with ardent but perceptibly waning fascination. The maze was entirely her invention. She had designed it and fashioned its wooden mechanisms herself. She had even tinkered with the mice to make them glow, though that had been the easy bit compared with all the fettling and filing that had been needed to get the traps and levers to work properly. For a while she even thought it had been worth it. One of the few things that could still interest Felker was emergence. On Diadem, the first world they had visited after leaving Mars in the very first near-light ship. Clavain, Galliana, and she had studied a vast crystalline organism, which took years to express anything resembling a single thought. Its synaptic messengers were mindless black worms, burrowing through a shifting neural network of capillary ice channels, threading an ageless glacier. Clavain and Galliana had wrenched her away from the proper study of the Diadem Glacier, and she had never quite forgiven them for it. Ever since, she had been drawn to similar systems, anything in which complexity emerged in an unpredictable fashion from simple elements. She had assembled countless simulations in software, but had never convinced herself that she was really capturing the essence of the problem. If complexity sprung from her systems, and it often had, she could never quite shake the sense that she had unwittingly built it in from the outset. The mice were a different approach. She had discarded the digital and embraced the analog. The first machine she had tried building had run on water. She had been inspired by details of a prototype that she had discovered in the Mother Nest's cybernetics archive. Centuries earlier, long before the trans-enlightenment, someone had made an analog computer which was designed to model the flow of money within an economy. The machine was all glass retorts and valves and delicately balanced seesaws. Tinted fluids represented different market pressures and financial parameters, interest rates, inflation, trade deficits. The machine sloshed and gurgled, computing ferociously difficult integral equations by the power of applied fluid mechanics. It had enchanted her. She had remade the prototype, adding a few sly refinements of her own. But though the machine had provided some amusement, she had seen only glimpses of emergent behavior. The machine was too ruthlessly deterministic to throw up any genuine surprises. Hence the mice. They were random agents, chaos on legs. She had concocted the new machine to exploit them, using their unpredictable scurrying to nudge it from state to state. The complex systems of levers and switches, trapdoors and junctions, ensured that the maze was constantly mutating, squirming through phase space, the mind-wrenching higher-dimensional mathematical space of all possible configurations that the maze could be in. There were attractors in that phase space, like planets and stars dimpling a sheet of space-time. When the maze fell towards one of them, it would often go into a kind of orbit, oscillating around one state until something, either a build-up of instability or an external kick, sent it careering elsewhere. Usually all that was needed was to tip a new mouse into the maze. Occasionally the maze would fall towards an attractor that caused the mice to be rewarded with more than the usual amount of food. She had been curious as to whether the mice, acting blindly, unable to knowingly cooperate with each other, would nonetheless find a way to steer the maze into the vicinity of one of those attractors. That, if it happened, would surely be a sign of emergence. It had happened, once, but that batch of mice had never repeated the trick since. Felka had tipped more mice into the system, but they had only clogged up the maze, locking it near another attractor where nothing very interesting happened. She had not completely given up on it. There were still subtleties of the maze that she did not fully understand, and until she did, it would not begin to bore her. But at the back of her mind, the fear was already there. She knew, beyond any doubt, that the maze could not fascinate her for very much longer. The maze clicked and clunked like a grandfather clock winding up to strike the hour. She heard the shutter-like clicking of doors opening and closing. The details of the maze were difficult to see behind the glass, but the flow of the mice betrayed its shifting geometry well enough. Felka! A man forced his way through the connecting throat. He floated into the room, arresting his drift with a press of fingertips against polished wood. She could see his face faintly. His bald skull was not quite the right shape. It seemed even odder in the gloom, like an elongated grey egg. She stared at it, knowing that, by rights, she should always have been able to associate that face with Remontoire. But had six or seven men of about the same physiological age entered the room, possessing the same childlike or neotenous facial features, she would not have been able to pick Remontoire out from them. It was only the fact that he had visited her recently that made her so certain it was him.
Hello, Remontoire. Could we have some light, please? Or shall we talk in the other chamber?
Here will do nicely. I'm in the middle of running an experiment.
He glanced at the glass wall. Will light spoil it?
No, but then I wouldn't be able to see the mice, would I?
I suppose not, Remontoire said thoughtfully. Clavain's with me. He'll be here in a moment.
Oh.
She fumbled one of the lanterns on. Turquoise light wavered uncertainly and then settled down. She studied Remontoire's expression, doing her best to read it. Even now that she knew his identity, it was not as if his face had become a model of clarity. Its text remained hazy, full of shifting ambiguities. Even reading the commonest of expressions required an intense effort of will, like picking out constellations in a sprinkling of faint stars. Now and then, admittedly, there were occasions when her odd neural machinery managed to grasp patterns that normal people missed entirely. But for the most part, she could never trust her own judgment when it came to faces. She bore this in mind when she looked at Remontoire's face, deciding provisionally that he looked concerned.
Why isn't he here now?
He wanted to give us time to discuss closed council matters.
Does he know anything about what happened in the chamber today?
Nothing.
Felker drifted to the top of the maze and popped another mouse into the entrance, hoping to unblock a stalemate in the lower left quadrant.
That's the way it will have to continue, unless Clavain assents to join. Even then he may be disappointed at what he doesn't get to know.
I understand why you wouldn't want him to know about Exordium, Remontoire said.
What exactly is that supposed to mean?
You went against Galliana's wishes, didn't you? After what she discovered on Mars, she discontinued Exordium. Yet when you returned from deep space, when she was still out there, you happily participated.
You've become quite an expert all of a sudden, Remontoire.
It's all there in the Mother Nest's archives, if you know where to look. The fact that the experiments took place isn't much of a secret at all.
Remontoire paused, watching the maze with mild interest.
Of course, what actually happened in Exordium, why Galliana called it off, that's another matter entirely. There's no mention in the archives of any messages from the future. What was so disturbing about those messages that their very existence couldn't be acknowledged?
You're just as curious as I was.
Of course. But was it just curiosity that made you go against her wishes, Felker? Or was there something more? An instinct to rebel against your own mother, perhaps?
Felker held back her anger.
She wasn't my mother, Remontoire. We shared some genetic material. That's all we had in common. And no, it wasn't rebellion either.
I was looking for something else to engage my mind. Exordium was supposed to be about a new state of consciousness.
So you didn't know about the messages either?
I had heard rumors, but I didn't believe them. The easiest way to find out for myself seemed to be to participate.
But I didn't start Exordium again. The program had already been resurrected before our return. Skade wanted me to join it.
I think she thought the uniqueness of my mind might be of value to the program. But I only played a small part in it, and I left almost as soon as I had begun.
Why? Because it didn't work the way you'd hoped?
No. As a matter of fact, it worked very well. It was also the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced in my life.
He smiled at her for a moment, then his smile slowly vanished.
Why? Exactly.
I didn't believe in the existence of evil before, Remontoire. Now I'm not so certain.
He spoke as if he had misheard her.
Evil?
Yes,
she said softly. Now that the subject had been raised, she found herself remembering the smell and texture of the Exordium chamber as if it had been only yesterday, even though she had done all she could to steer her thoughts away from that sterile white room, unwilling to accept what she had learned within it. The experiments had been the logical conclusion to the work Galliana had initiated in her earliest days in the Martian labs. She had set out to enhance the human brain, believing that her work could only be for the greater good of humanity. As her model, Galliana used the development of the digital computer from its simple, slow infancy. Her first step had been to increase the computational power and speed of the human mind.
just as the early computer engineers had traded clockwork for electromechanical switches. Switches for valves, valves for transistors, transistors for microscopic solid-state devices, solid-state devices for quantum-level processing gates, which hovered on the fuzzy edge of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. She invaded the brains of her subjects, including herself, with tiny machines that laid down connections between brain cells which exactly paralleled those already in place, but which were capable of transmitting nerve signals much more rapidly. With the normal neurotransmitter and nerve signal events inhibited by drugs or more machines, Galeana's secondary loom took over neural processing. The subjective effect was normal consciousness, but at an accelerated rate. It was as if the brain had been supercharged, able to process thoughts at a rate 10 or 15 times faster than an unaugmented mind. There were problems, enough to ensure that accelerated consciousness could not usually be sustained for more than a few seconds, but in most respects the experiments had been successful. Someone in the accelerated state could watch an apple fall from a table and compose a commemorative haiku before it reached the ground. They could watch the depressor and elevator muscles flex and twist in a hummingbird's wing, or marvel at the crown-like impact pattern caused by a splashing drop of milk. They also, needless to say, made excellent soldiers. So Galeana had moved on to the next phase. The early computer engineers had discovered that certain classes of problems were best tackled by armies of computers locked together in parallel, sharing data between nodes. Galeana pursued this aim with her neurally enhanced subjects, establishing data corridors between their minds. She allowed them to share memories, experiences, even the processing of certain mental tasks, such as pattern recognition. It was this experiment, running amok, jumping uncontrolled from mind to mind, subverting neural machines which were already in place, that led to the event known as the Trans-Enlightenment, and, not inconsequentially, to the First War against the Conjoiners. The Coalition for Neural Purity had wiped out Galeana's allies, forcing her back into the seclusion of a small fortified huddle of labs, tucked inside the Great Wall of Mars. It was there, in 2190, that she had met Clavain for the first time, when he had been her prisoner. It was there that Felka had been born, a few years later. And it was there that Galeana pushed on to the third phase of her experimentation. Still following the model of the early computer engineers, she now wished to explore what could be gained from a quantum mechanical approach. The computer engineers in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, barely out of the clockwork era as far as Galeana was concerned, had used quantum principles to crack problems that would otherwise have been insoluble, such as the task of finding the prime factors of very large numbers. A conventional computer, even an army of conventional computers sharing the task, stood no chance of being able to find the prime factors before the effective end of the universe. And yet with the right equipment, an ungainly lash-up of prisms, lenses, lasers, and optical processors on a lab bench, it was possible to do it in a few milliseconds. There had been fierce debate as to exactly what was happening, but not that the primes were being found. The simplest explanation, which Galeana had never seen any reason to doubt, was that the quantum computers were sharing the task between infinite copies of themselves, spread across parallel universes. It was conceptually staggering, but it was the only reasonable explanation, and it was not something they had plucked out of thin air to justify a perplexing result. The idea of parallel worlds had long been at least one conceptual underpinning of quantum theory. And so Galeana had tried to do something similar with human minds. The exordium chamber was a device for coupling one or more augmented brains to a coherent quantum system, a bar of magnetically suspended rubidium that was being continually pumped into cycles of quantum coherence and collapse. During each episode of coherence, the bar was in a state of superposition with infinite counterparts of itself, and it was at this moment that a neural coupling was attempted. The act itself always forced the bar to collapse down to one macroscopic state, but the collapse was not instantaneous. There was a moment when some of the bar's coherence bled back into the linked minds, putting them into weak superposition with their own parallel world counterparts. In that moment, Galliana hoped there might be some perceptible change in the experienced consciousness state of the participant. Her theories, however, did not say what the change might be. It was, in the end, nothing like she had expected. Galliana had never spoken to Felker about her detailed impressions, but Felker had learned enough to know that her own experience must have been broadly similar. When the experiment began, with the subject or subjects lying on couches in the chamber, their heads swallowed in the gaping white maws of high-resolution neural interfacing trawls, there was a presentiment, like the aura that warned of an impending epileptic seizure. Then there would come a sensation that Felker had never been adequately able to describe outside of the experiment. All she could say was that her thoughts suddenly became plural, as if behind every thought she detected the faint choral echo of others that almost perfectly shadowed it. She did not sense an infinity of such thoughts, but she did sense, faintly, that they receded into something, diverging at the same time. She was, in that moment, in touch with counterparts of herself. Then something far stranger would begin to happen. Impressions would gather and solidify, like the phantoms that take shape after hours of sensory deprivation. She became aware of something stretching ahead of her, into a dimension she could not quite visualize, but which nonetheless conveyed a tremendous sense of distance and remoteness. Her mind would grasp at the vague sensory clues and throw some kind of familiar framework over them. She would see a long white corridor, stretching towards infinity, washed out in bleak, colorless light, and she would know, without being able to articulate quite how she knew, that what she was seeing was a corridor into the future. Numerous pale doors or apertures, each of which opened into some more remote future epoch, lined the corridor. Galliana had never intended to open a door into that corridor, but it seemed that she had made it possible. Felker sensed that the corridor could not be traversed. One could only stand at its end and listen for messages that came down it. And there would be messages. Like the corridor itself, they were filtered through her own perceptions. It was impossible to say from how far in the future they had come, or what exactly the future that had sent them looked like. Was it even possible for a particular future to communicate with the past without causing paradoxes? In trying to answer this, Felker had come across the nearly forgotten work of a physicist named Deutsch, a man who had published his thoughts 200 years before Galliana's experiments. Deutsch had argued that the way to view time was not as a flowing river, but as a series of static snapshots stacked together to form space-times, in which the flow of time was only a subjective illusion. Deutsch's picture explicitly permitted past-directed time travel, with the preservation of free will, and yet without paradoxes. The catch was that a particular future could only communicate with the past of another universe. Wherever these messages were coming from, they were not from Galliana's future. They might be from one that was very close to it, but it would never be one she could reach. No matter. The exact nature of the future was less important than the content of the messages themselves. Felker had never learned the precise content of the messages Galliana had received, but she could guess. They had probably been along the same lines as the ones that came through during Felker's brief period of participation. They would be instructions for making things, clues or signposts that pointed them in the right direction rather than detailed blueprints, or there would be edicts or warnings. But by the time those distant transmissions had reached the participants in the Exordium experiments, they had been reduced to half-heard echoes, corrupted like Chinese whispers, intermingled and threaded with dozens of intervening messages. It was as if there was only one open conduit between the present and the future, with a finite bandwidth. Every message sent reduced the potential capacity for future messages. But it was not the actual content of the messages that was alarming, rather the thing that Felker had glimpsed behind them. She had sensed a mind. "We touched something," she told Remontois,
Or rather, something touched us. It reached down the corridor and grazed against our minds, coming through at the same time as we received the instructions.
And that was the evil thing?
I can't think of any other way to describe it. Merely encountering it, merely sharing its thoughts for an instant, drove most of us insane, or left us dead. She looked at their reflections in the glass wall. But I survived.
You were lucky.
No. It wasn't luck, not entirely. Just that I recognized the thing, so the shock of encountering it wasn't so absolute, and because it recognized me, too. It withdrew as soon as it touched my mind and concentrated on the others.
What was it? Ramantois asked. If you recognized it.
I wish I hadn't. I've had to live with that moment of recognition ever since, and it hasn't been easy.
So what was it? He persisted.
I think it was Galliana, Falca said. I think it was her mind.
In the future?
In a future. Not ours, or at least not precisely.
Ramantois smiled uneasily.
Galliana's dead. We both know that. How could her mind have spoken to you from the future, even if it was a slightly different one from ours? It can't have been that different.
I don't know. I wonder, and I keep wondering, how she became like that.
And that's why you left?
You'd have done the same thing.
Falco watched the mouse take a wrong turning, not the one she had hoped it would take.
You're angry with me, aren't you? You feel that I betrayed her.
Irrespective of what you've just told me, yes.
I suppose I do.
His tone had softened.
I don't blame you, but I had to do it, Ramantois. I had to do it once. I don't regret that at all, even though I wish I hadn't learned what I did.
Ramantois whispered, And Clavaine, does he know any of this?
Of course not. It would kill him.
There was a rap of knuckle against wood. Clavaine pushed his way into the space, glancing at the maze before speaking.
Talking about me behind my back again, are you?
Actually, we weren't really talking about you at all, Falca said.
That's a disappointment.
Have some tea, Clavaine. It should still be drinkable.
Clavaine took the bulb she offered.
Is there anything you want to share with me about what happened in the closed council meeting?
We can't discuss specifics, Ramantois said. All I can say is that there is considerable pressure for you to join. Some of that pressure comes from conjoiners, who feel that your loyalty to the Mother Nest will always be questionable until you come in from the cold.
They've got a bloody cheek.
Ramantois and Falca exchanged glances. Perhaps, Ramantois said.
There are also those, your allies, I suppose, who feel that you have more than demonstrated your loyalty over the years.
That's more like it.
But they'd also like you in the closed council, Falca said. The way they see it, once you're in the council, you won't be able to go around putting yourself in dangerous situations. They view it as a way of safeguarding a valuable asset.
Clavaine scratched his beard.
So what you're saying is I can't win either way, is that it?
There's a minority that would be quite happy to see you remain out of the closed council, Ramantois said. Some are your staunchest allies. Some, however, think that letting you continue to play soldier is the easiest way to get you killed.
Nice to know I'm appreciated.
And what do you two think?
Ramantois spoke softly.
The closed council needs you, Clavaine. Now more than ever.
Something unspoken passed between them then, Falca sensed. It was not neural communication, but something far older. Something that could only be understood by friends who had known and trusted each other for a very long time. Clavaine nodded gravely and then looked at Falca.
You know my position, she said. I've known you and Ramantois since my childhood on Mars. You were there for me, Clavaine. You went back into Galliana's nest and saved me when she said it was hopeless. You never gave up on me. Through all the years that followed, you made me into something other than what I was. You made me into a person.
And now?
Galliana isn't here, she said. That's one less link to my past, Clavaine. I don't think I could stand to lose another.
In a repair berth on the rim of Carousel New Copenhagen, in the outer habitat lane of the Circum-Yellowstone Rust Belt, Xavier Liu was having considerable difficulty with monkeys. The shop steward, who was not a monkey at all but an enhanced orangutan, had pulled all of Xavier's squiddle monkeys out of the workshop at short notice. It was not Xavier's fault. His own labor relations had always been good, but the orangutan had ordered the workers to down tools in sympathy with a party of striking colobus monkeys halfway around the rim. As far as Xavier could tell, the dispute had something to do with lemurs, who were working at below union rates and thereby taking work away from higher primates. It was the sort of thing that might have been mildly interesting, even amusing, had it not impacted his latest job. But, Xavier reflected, it very much came with the territory. If he did not like working with monkeys, or apes, or prosimians, or even the occasional group of pygmy sloths, he should not have chosen to set up business in Carousel, New Copenhagen. The outer habitat lane was a bristling grey torus, spinning within the rust belt, the ramshackle procession of habitats, and the gutted remains of habitats that, despite all that had happened, still orbited Yellowstone. Habitats came in all shapes and sizes, even before they began to suffer age, sabotage, and collision. Some were enormous, air-filled cylinders or spheres, adorned with mirrors and delicate gold sunshades. Others had been constructed on small asteroids or comet fragments, eased into orbit around Yellowstone by armies of skyjacks. Sometimes the habitats wormed deep within these solid foundations, transforming their rocky hearts into a confusion of vertiginous plazas and air-filled public spaces. Others were built mainly on the surface, for ease of access to and from local space. These domed, low-grav communities were clumped together like frog spawn, shot through with the iridescent green and blue of miniature biomes. Typically, the domes showed evidence of hasty repair work, scars and spiderwebs of emergency epoxy sealant or foam diamond. Some had not been resealed, and what lay within was dark and lifeless, like the ashes of a fire. Other habitats conformed to less pragmatic designs. There were wild spirals and helices, like blown glass or nautilus shells. There were enormous concatenations of spheres and tubes, resembling organic molecules. There were habitats that reshaped themselves continually, slow symphonic movements of pure architecture. There were others that had clung to an outmoded design through stubborn centuries, resisting all innovation and frippery. A few others had cloaked themselves in fogs of pulverized matter, concealing their true design. Then there were the derelicts. Some had been evacuated during the plague and had suffered no major catastrophes afterwards, but the majority had been struck by collision fragments from other habitats that had already crashed and burned. A few had been scuttled, blown apart by nuclear charges. Not much remained of those. Some had been reclaimed and refitted during the years of reconstruction. A few were still held by aggressive squatters, despite the best efforts of the Ferrisville Convention to evict them. Carousel New Copenhagen had weathered the plague years more successfully than some, but it had not come through totally unscathed. In the current era, it was a single fat ring, rotating slowly. The rim of the ring was a kilometer wide. Seen from a distance, it was a festering blur of intricate structures, as if a strip of industrial cityscape had been wound on the outside of a wheel. Closer, it resolved into a coral-like mass of gantries and cranes and docking bays, service towers and recessed parking bays, spindly latticework exfoliating into vacuum, studded with a million stuttering lights of welding torches, advertising slogans, and winking landing beacons. Arriving and departing ships, even in wartime, formed a haze of insect motion around the rim. Traffic management around Copenhagen was a headache. At one time, the wheel had rotated at twice its current rate, sufficient to generate a G of centrifugal gravity at the rim. Ships had docked in the D-spun hub, still in freefall. Then, at the height of the plague, when the former glitter band was being downgraded to the rust belt, a rogue chunk of another habitat had taken out the entire central hub. The rim had been left spinning alone, spokeless. There had been deaths, inevitably, many hundreds of them. Emergency ships had been parked where the hub had been,
loading evacuees to ferry down to Chasm City. The precision of the impact had looked suspicious, but subsequent examination showed that it had been caused by exceptional bad luck. Yet Copenhagen had survived. The carousel was an old one and not especially reliant on the microscopic technologies that the plague had subverted. For the millions who lived within it, life continued almost as it had before. With no easy location for new ships to dock, evacuation was painstaking at best. By the time the plague's worst months were over, Copenhagen was still mostly inhabited. The citizenry had kept their carousel running where others had been abandoned to the care of faltering machines. They had steered it out of the way of further collisions and taken ruthless measures to stamp out plague outbreaks within their own habitats. Barring the odd subsequent accident, like the time Lyle Merrick had slammed a chemical-drive freighter into the rim, gouging the crater that the tourist ghoul still came to drool over, the carousel had survived major catastrophe pretty much intact. In the years of the reconstruction, the carousel had tried, time and again, to raise the funds for rebuilding the central hub. They had never succeeded. The merchants and shipowners complained that they were losing commerce because it was so hard to land on the moving rim, but the citizenry refused to allow the wheel to be spun down, since they had grown accustomed to gravity. Eventually they reached a compromise that pleased neither side. The spin rate was sapped by 50%, dropping rim gravity by one half. It was still tricky to berth a ship, but not quite as tricky as it had been before. Besides, the citizenry argued, departing ships were given a free kick by the carousel, flung away at a tangent. They shouldn't complain. The pilots were not impressed. They pointed out that they had already burned the fuel that would have given them that kick during the approach itself. But the unusual arrangement turned out to have strange benefits. During the occasionally lawless years that followed, their carousel was immune to most kinds of piracy. Squatters went elsewhere. And some pilots deliberately berthed their ships on Copenhagen's rim because they preferred to make certain repairs under gravity, rather than in the usual freefall docks that the other habitats offered. Things had even begun to perk up before the outbreak of war. Tentative scaffolding pointed inwards from the wheel, hinting at the spokes that would come later, followed by a new hub. There were thousands of dry docks on the rim. They came in many sizes and shapes to accommodate all major classes of in-system ship. They were mostly recessed back into the rim, with the lower side open to space. Ships had to be eased up into a dock, usually aided by robot tug, before being anchored securely into place with heavy-duty docking clamps. Anything not anchored fell back out into space, usually for good. It made working on berthed ships interesting, and it was work that required a head for heights, but there were always takers. The ship that Xavier Liu was working on, alone, now that his monkey had gone on strike, was not one he had serviced before, but he had worked on many of the same basic type. She was a Rust Belt runner, a small semi-automated cargo hauler designed to nip between habitats. Her hull was a skeletal frame onto which many storage pods could be hung, like Christmas tree ornaments. The hauler had been running between the Swift Augustine cylinder and a carousel controlled by the House of Correction, a shadowy firm that specialized in the discreet reversal of cosmetic surgical procedures. There were passengers aboard the hauler, each packed into a single customized storage pod. When the hauler had detected a technical fault in its navigation system, it had located the nearest carousel capable of offering immediate repairs, and had made an offer of work. Xavier's firm had returned a competitive bid, and the hauler had steered towards Copenhagen. Xavier had made sure there were robot tugs to assist the hauler towards its berth, and was now clambering around the frame of the ship, adhesive patches on his soles and palms gripping him to ticking cold metal. Tools of varying complexity hung from his spacesuit belt, and a compad of recent vintage gripped his left sleeve. Periodically, he spooled out a line and plugged it into a data port in the hauler's chassis, biting his tongue as he made sense of the numbers. He knew that the fault in the nav system, whatever it was, would turn out to be relatively simple to fix. Once you found the fault,
It was usually just a matter of ordering a replacement component from stores. A monkey would normally have brought it to him within a few minutes. The trouble was he had been climbing around this hauler for 45 minutes, and the precise source of the error was still eluding him. This was a problem, since the terms of the bid guaranteed that he would have the hauler back on its journey within 6 hours. He had used up most of the first hour already, including the time it had taken to park the ship. 5 hours was normally plenty of time, but he was beginning to have the nasty feeling that this was going to be one of those jobs that ended with his firm paying out penalty money. Xavier clambered past one of the storage pods.
"Give me a fucking clue, you bastard."
The hauler's sub-persona was shrill in his earpiece.
"Have you found the fault in me? I am most anxious to continue my mission."
"No, shut up. I need to think."
"I repeat, I am most anxious."
"Shut the fuck up!"
There was a clear patch near the front of the pod. He had so far avoided paying too much attention to any of the recipients, but this time he saw more than he intended to. There was a thing inside like a winged horse, except horses, even winged horses, did not have perfectly human female faces. Xavier looked away as the face's eyes met his own. He spooled his line into another plug, hoping that this time he would nail the problem. Maybe there was nothing actually wrong with the nav system, just with the fault diagnostics web. Hadn't that happened once before, with that hauler that came in on a slush puppy run from Hotel Amnesia? He glanced at the time display in the bottom right corner of his faceplate. 5 hours, 10 minutes left, including the time he would need to run health checks and slide the hauler back out into empty space. It was not looking good.
"Have you found the fault in me? I am most..."
But at least it kept his mind off the other thing, he supposed. Up against the clock, with a knotty technical problem to solve, he did not think about Antoinette with quite the usual frequency. It had not become any easier to deal with her absence. He had not agreed with her little errand, but had known that the last thing she needed was him trying to argue her out of it. Her own doubts must have been strong enough. So he had done what he could. He had traded favors with another repair shop that had some spare capacity, and they had pulled Stormbird into their service bay, the second largest in all of Copenhagen. Antoinette had looked on nervously, convinced that the docking clamps could not possibly hold the freighter in place against its 100,000 tons of centripetal weight. But the ship had held, and Xavier's monkeys had given it a thorough service. Later, when the work was done, Xavier and Antoinette had made love for the last time before she went away. Antoinette had stepped back behind the airlock bulkhead, and a few minutes after that, on the edge of tears, Xavier had watched Stormbird depart, falling away until it looked impossibly small and fragile. A little while after that, the shop had received a visit from a nastily inquisitive proxy of the Ferrisville Convention, a frightening, sharp-edged contraption that crawled around for several hours, seemingly just to intimidate Xavier, before finding nothing and losing interest. Nothing else had happened. Antoinette had told him that she would maintain radio silence when she was in the war zone, so he was not surprised at first when he did not hear from her. Then the general news nets had carried vague reports of some kind of military activity near Tangerine Dream, the gas giant where Antoinette was planning to bury her father. That was not supposed to have happened. Antoinette had planned her trip to coincide with a lull in military maneuvers in that part of the system. The reports had not mentioned a civilian vessel being caught up in the struggle, but that meant nothing. Perhaps she had been hit by crossfire, her death unknown to anyone but Xavier. Or perhaps they knew she had died, but did not want to advertise the fact that a civilian ship had strayed so far into a contested volume. As the days turned into weeks, and still there had been no report from her, he had forced himself to accept that she was dead. She had died nobly, doing something courageous, if pointless, in the middle of a war. She had not allowed herself to be sucked into cynical abnegation. He was proud to have known her, and quietly tormented that he would not see her again.
"I must ask again, have you found the fault?"
Xavier tapped commands into his sleeve, disconnecting his comms from the sub-persona. Let the bastard thing stew a bit, he thought. He glanced at the clock. 4 hours, 55 minutes. And he was still no closer to identifying the problem. In fact, one or two lines of inquiry that had looked quite promising a few minutes earlier had turned out to be resolute dead ends. Fuck this bastard piece of... Something pulsed green on his sleeve. Xavier studied it through a fog of irritation and mild panic. How ironic it would be, he thought, if the shop went out of business anyway, even though he had stayed behind. His sleeve was telling him that he was receiving an urgent signal from outside Carousel New Copenhagen. It was coming in right at that moment, routed through to the shop via the Carousel's general comms net. The message was talk only, and there was no option to respond in real time, since whoever was transmitting was too far downstream, which meant that whoever was sending was well outside the rust belt. Xavier told his sleeve to route the message through to his helmet, spooling back to the start of the transmission.
Xavier, I hope you get this. I hope that the shop is still in business, and that you haven't called in too many favors recently, because I'm going to have to ask you to call in a hell of a lot more.
Antoinette,
he said aloud, despite himself, grinning like an idiot.
All you need to know is what I'm about to tell you. The rest we can go over later in person. I'm on my way back now, but I've got way too much Delta V to make the Rust Belt. You need to get a salvage tug up to my speed and pretty damn quickly. Haven't they got a couple of Taurus IVs over at the Laszlo dock? One of those can handle Stormbird easily. I'm sure they owe us for that job down to Dax or Trichium last year.
She gave him coordinates and a vector, and told him to be alert for Banshee activity in the sector she had specified. Antoinette was right. She was moving very quickly indeed. Xavier wondered what had happened, but figured that he would find out soon enough. The timing was tight, too. She had left it to the last minute to transmit the message, which only gave him a narrow window to sort out the deal with the Taurus IVs. No more than half a day, or the tugs would not be able to reach her. Then the problem would be 10 times harder to solve, and would require the calling in of favors far outside Xavier's range. Antoinette liked to live dangerously, he reflected. He turned his attention back to the hauler. He was no closer to solving the problem with the nav system, but somehow it no longer weighed on his mind with quite the same sense of extreme urgency. Xavier prodded his sleeve again, reconnecting with the sub-persona. It buzzed immediately in his ear. It was as if it had been talking to him all along, even when he was no longer listening. Fault yet? It is most strenuously urged that you remedy this error within the promised time period. Failure to comply with the terms of the repair bid will render you liable to penalty charges of not more than 60,000 ferris units, or not more than 120,000 if the failure to comply is... He unplugged his sleeve again. Blissful silence descended. Nimbly, Xavier climbed off the chassis of the hauler. He hopped the short distance back on to one of the bay's repair ledges, landing amid tools and spooled cable. He turned off the grip in his palm and steadied himself, taking one last look at the hauler to make sure he had left no valuable tools lying around on it. He had not. Xavier flipped open a panel in the oil-smeared wall of the bay. There were many controls behind the wall. Huge toy-like grease-smeared buttons and levers. Some controlled electrical power and lighting. Others governed pressurization and temperature. He ignored all these, his palm coming to rest above a very prominent lever marked in scarlet, the control that undid the docking clamps. Xavier looked back towards the hauler. It was silly, really, what he was going to do. A little more work, an hour or so perhaps, and he might stand a very good chance of tracking down the fault. Then the hauler could go on its way. There would be no penalty fees, and the repair shop's slide into insolvency would have been arrested, if only for the next couple of weeks. Set against that, however, was the possibility that he would continue working for the next 5 hours and still not find the problem. Then there would be penalty charges, not more than 120,000 ferris, as the hauler had helpfully informed him, as if knowing the upper limit in some way lessened the sting, and the fact that he would be 5 hours late in arranging Antoinette's rescue. It was no contest, really.
Xavier tugged down the scarlet lever. He felt it lock into its new position with a satisfyingly old-fashioned mechanical clunk. Immediately, orange warning lights started flashing all around the bay. An alarm sounded in his helmet, telling him to keep well away from moving metal. The clamps retracted in a rapid flurry, like telegraphic relays. For a moment the hauler hung suspended, magically. Then centrifugal gravity took over, and with something close to majesty the skeletal spacecraft descended out of the repair bay as smoothly and elegantly as a falling chandelier. Xavier was denied a view of the hauler dwindling into the distance. The carousel's rotation snatched it out of his line of sight. He could wait until the next pass, but he had work to do. The hauler was unharmed, he knew. Once it was clear of Copenhagen, another repair specialist would undoubtedly pick it up. In a few hours it would probably be back on its way to the House of Correction with its load of unfashionably mutated passengers. Of course, there would still be hell to pay from a number of quarters. The passengers themselves, if they ever got wind, Swift Augustine, the habitat that had sent them, the cartel that owned the hauler, maybe even the House of Correction itself, for endangering its clients. They could all go fuck themselves. He had heard from Antoinette, and that was all that mattered.